Hello, and welcome back to Just Hands. Sorry to all the listeners. We've been off the air for around a month, which is kind of crazy. It just sort of happened. There were actually a couple of attempts to record episodes that were thwarted by various means. One of them being that I forgot to press record, which was pretty brutal. Definitely the worst beat I've taken over the last 5 weeks or so. Anyways, we are back with plans to continue releasing regularly. But I am requesting some help. Basically, you guys know that there's no regular co-host at the moment. It's possible that we will bring on another co-host, but it's also possible that I'll just keep going solo. Anyways, either way, you know that we've been featuring listener hands for a while now, but what I think would be interesting and helpful to me is if, rather than just talk about a listener hands, if listeners actually came on the show and discussed those hands, I think it would be pretty valuable in terms of trying to get to the root of some of the issues that you guys are having. I think it's possible that you could learn more hearing from each other than hearing from the, you know, various pros that normally come on the podcast to do the guest spots. Anyways, if any of you are interested in coming on the podcast, I invite you to send me an email at jack@justhandspoker.com. Send me an email with your hand history and, you know, letting me know that you are writing me that you want to come on the show. And I'll get back to you to try and schedule a time. And yeah, I'd love to make that happen, have some episodes out soon in the next few weeks that feature some of you guys. So if you're interested, again, message me at jack@justhandspoker.com. All right, guys, thanks for tuning in and enjoy this week's episode. Hello, and welcome back to the Just Hands podcast. It's been a little bit while since we've had an episode, so I had to make sure that we came back on a high note. And we are joined here by New York poker legend, Fausto Valdez. Fausto, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Jack. Thanks for having me. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling good. We just got to hang out for a little while at the Software Y Academy. We are both alumni who were back, I guess, doing a combination of teaching and just hanging out. And you and I were hanging in the back room with Matt Hunt, watching the gameplay, having the secondary commentary, which was a lot of fun. And yeah, I'm glad to get you on the podcast.
Yeah, for sure. And the academy definitely was a lot of fun, getting the insight from everybody.
Yeah, it's a good hang. So, I hear you have a hand for me.
Yeah, I have a hand. Want to continue on the discussions, different discussions we were talking about. I think this hand is interesting because it kind of breaks the traditional thinking where I think a lot of players do. So I wanted to see like what you think.
Cool.
You might actually know this hand already, but I'll bring it up anyways. So, playing 2-5 at the casino that I usually go to, which is Sands in PA. And the dynamic had been very aggressive, partially due by me and some other guy. And this hand came up where I have ace-queen offsuit. I opened to 35, I believe it was. 30 or 35 from like middle position. And then two late position players called me who were fairly sticky in the sense that they call a lot, but they will play a little more on the passive side, but they'll challenge me here and there post flop. And then we have the other aggressive guy I mentioned calling from the blinds. So in a pot of 140, the flop comes queen 9-7 with a 9 and the 7 being the hearts. And everybody's effective stack is about, well, me and the aggressive guy, which is the main villain, we have about around 1,400-1,500. The other guys have about like 500 or 600. So that SPR is rather like close with them. So flop top, pair top kicker. And to my surprise, not really, but the aggressive guy just leads into me for around half pot. So what are you thinking in the spot?
Okay, so do you have the Queen of Hearts or the Ace of Hearts?
I do not.
Okay. First of all, this is a good spot, I think, to be leading into the field, particularly because most people opening pots aren't you. And I think players are going to typically respond somewhat fit or fold in a four-way pot. And also, part of that fit or fold nature is that their raising range is going to be, for the most part, very strong. And, you know, might not include hands like ace-queen. Okay, so since I think the field conditions, you know, a more aggressive player to see the merits in leading here with many hands that are worse than ace-queen, almost all hands are worse, I think there's a very good case for raising. We put players behind who are going to be getting a very good price on a call with hands that have the right equity to call in position. You know, we would, you know, be very happy to see a hand like King 10 with a heart, King Jack with a heart, even a hand like, I mean, I think getting Jack 10 to fold is a little optimistic, but it could happen. Or a hand like 9 10 or something like that. All these hands are hands where I think it's easy for some of the listeners, I think, to be in the mindset that these hands are worse and therefore we want them to call. The thing to realize is that when we call, players behind us are being laid 4-1 and they're in position on a dynamic board. And right. So if we can get them to fold out their equity rather than make what is very likely a plus EV call, you know, and by nature of a call being plus EV, it means they're taking money out of the pot. I think to stop people from doing that through a raise makes a lot of sense. And I think that we're doing quite well against the leading range. I mean, obviously, when we get 3-bet, we're probably not folding, although now we're sort of in bluff catch mode, which is fine. But I think that plenty of worse one-pair hands and draws are going to be leading. And between the denial of the other two players and targeting a range that we have an equity advantage against, I think that all makes a lot of sense if you ended up deciding to raise, which I don't know. I just assume that you raised.
You know me too well, Jack. Yeah. I basically did raise for literally all the points you mentioned. And I think it's important to talk about all that because for the traditional player, maybe that somebody's learning, I think it's very easy to get caught up in the, oh, this guy's really aggressive. I have a hand. let me let him bluff off, right? So you enter like this bluff catch mentality, which is not bad in certain cases or certain boards, but in this specific situation where we're stuck in the middle and we have guys play behind us where I deemed relatively sticky, where they will continue, that increases given the board dynamic where they have a lot of available hands that could continue. So if we forget about that aspect and we don't plan ahead for like possible runouts, we get ourselves in murky spots later on. So for all the things you mentioned where like denying their equity, because everybody has a share of equity here. So like I have a piece and like me calling is plus EV, but I think me denying them is even more plus EV where now I buy up that equity and I collectively get my respective share while the other villain retains his. So getting more equity is very good for us. And I basically want to set up the turn to like now play poker, right? Like I basically want to isolate this player and then we'll figure it out. But first step is getting these other two guys out, you know, for the denying purpose and buying up equity. So yeah, I did raise him. From what I remember, he led around 75, which is basically half pot. Now, my raising size, I specifically picked it to set up turn like all-ins situations. So I raised it to basically 3x, around 225, which would have been enough to play big pots on the turn. So I did go to 225. He calls. Well, the other two guys fold, first of all, and this guy calls. So now, so that's 450 plus. So it's like 600 going into the turn, just about. And the turn is basically a brick, which is like a four of like clubs or something. Doesn't bring any backdoors or anything. And the player checks. It's on to me. And given that he had about around 1K at this point, I wanted to pick a sizing that allows him to, like, possibly reshove if he thinks he could get me off. Given that I think most of his range is made up of the Queen X and the hearts that will take that leading range, given his tendencies and his nature, which I beat. So I wanted to give him the possibility of, like, reshoving. So I picked a sizing of around, like, 310. He thinks about for 5 seconds and then reshoves. What do you think about all that?
So if we start back at our raise size on the flop, I think I might size a little bit bigger. Basically, feeling like this. So this guy, you know, we know this guy is aggressive. And so when we know we can get this outcome of, like, you know, the small raise, small turn bet, induce a shove from a range that ace-queen is probably doing pretty well against. Like, obviously, he plays plenty of better hands this way. But I think we're normally, like, pretty happy to get an ace-queen on this board with, you know, these stacks in a four-way pot. So when this happens, I think it's all fine. I think, though, there's a pretty good case for raising larger on the flop to set up our own turn shove. So what's nice about, I think, shoving the turn on a card like this in this sort of, on this board, is that we get almost all the draws to relinquish their equity since they, you know, they're not getting the right price. And I think that the calling range is just mostly hands that we were, you know, either fucked against or are doing very well against. You know, if he just has queen nine, then
right,
you know, we lose. But we were already losing everything against that hand on most runouts. And so in terms of your denial purposes, I think your flop size is great. So it's really just kind of an awkward SPR in terms of, do we want to try and set up something a little closer to pot or give ourselves the opportunity to make this sort of smaller sizing? So I guess you bet just about half pot on the turn.
Right.
Yeah. I'm into it, honestly.
So, like, I definitely agree with what you said if leverage was closer. Because, like, I couldn't meet leverage in a way that would, like, represent the rest of my range in an effective manner. Because if I wanted to do what you mentioned, I would have to raise, like, so he made it, like, 75. I would have to raise, like, 400 or 500, something like that, to get close to that pot size shove, you know? Or maybe a little bit lower, I guess. Maybe 3-something, which we definitely could do. Actually, now I'm probably convincing myself to do that.
Well, I'm thinking, like, somewhere around a pot size raise, which is, like, right around 375.
Like 5x, okay.
You know, because when we're raising over half pot, our sizings are generally going to be more than 3x size. But I think an aggressive player.
Yeah.
I'm coming around to your size. I really like what you did, because I think when we're up against someone who's aggressive and is going to, you know, take suboptimal bluffing lines,
right,
keeping their range wide. Like, I think when we raise to 375, when this guy has, like, queen 10 or 9-10 or something like that, that was sort of a feeler lead, I think he folds a lot of those hands to 400, where he never folds to 225. Yeah. And it makes us calling down on worse runouts a lot more feasible. You know, there's nothing wrong, I think, like, to raising to 400, seeing a heart roll off on the turn, getting led into and folding. I don't think that's a terrible outcome by any means, but I think when we make it smaller, we can peel a bet a lot more easily because his range is just so much wider. And since he's an opportunistic bluffer, we're going to be able to realize our equity a bit more effectively, I think.
Yeah. What I do, I mean, I think both sides have pros and cons, and I guess it's just a matter of strategy, but I think in a better good strategy, picking the larger sizing will help, just because it's more effective in terms of capitalizing and getting him to fold when we do have bluffs. And if that is so, then we want to represent our value in the same manner, right? So we're more balanced that way. So on an opponent like that, I will be looking for spots where he's more in the merge and like vulnerable side of his range and like attacking that a lot. And naturally, I'm going to pick a slightly larger sizing just so it's not so easy for him to call a, like a 3X. And, you know, going back to that, I think balancing that with like your top side will be very good. So naturally, I would do that. And I think picking the smaller sizing is more of like an explorative play where like I know he's never going to fold. And I'm basically setting him up in a way going into the next street that he's just going to feel committed for the most part. And basically feeding into his tendencies where like he's just naturally aggressive. So if he does have a combo draw or a hard flush draw, basically almost any draw, like he's going to feel the need to like try to possibly push me out in the way that I originally set it out. But I think that scenario won't be as effective if I did have a bluff, given everything I just mentioned, because it's not going to work with this kind of player, given his aggressive tendencies. So I think I could do it exploratively, but if I wanted to do like a really good hard strategy versus this guy where I could capitalize effectively throughout the session, I think possibly your sizing is probably a little bit better.
So I definitely see what you mean in terms of, you know, in sort of a balanced way, being able to capitalize more effectively on this street of play with the larger sizing. I'm curious, so the half pot lead versus, or what do you see as possible differences in terms of construction for this player's half pot lead versus maybe a pot size lead on this board?
I think when he does half pot, it's more natural for him to have other quote unquote vulnerable hands, which is like the queen nexus, like queen jack, queen 10, possibly his queen 9, which would be top two. But it will start falling more in that sense. And then like if he really wants to expand this range, he'll start taking some 9x combinations as well, where he probably feels that he needs to capitalize himself in a multi-way pot, or he's trying to shut off players as well so he could realize that equity of 9x more effectively going to the river, especially since the board texture is dynamic, so he might expect some resistance. So maybe he wants to shut off some people. So I think it's more natural for him to pick a half pot sizing and do that. When when he goes pot, it's very unnatural to include those hands. Just, it's not as effective. And people just don't do that naturally, just picking a pot size bet, polarizing the range while including those middle hands. So when he does do this, and given his tendencies, I could pretty pinpoint his range to definitely queen nexus, which is great because I'm not facing such a condensed tight range. So there's more hands that I could target later down. And then his combo draws, his ace-x flush draws, and perhaps jack-10 including in there, which will be the best straight draw for him.
Right. I definitely agree from the value side that the sort of middle of range becomes a lot more likely when he chooses this sizing. I think the top of range value hands go down in likelihood. I think the draws are interesting and a little bit unpredictable. The way I approach these situations, essentially, I think there are some iterations of this player or these types of players who basically would never lead a draw here. And there are other types who always lead draws. Yeah. And I think that the sort of value side of things is a lot more predictable in this sort of spot. And so I think you kind of have to treat all the draws as possible with the understanding that maybe each of them individually is less likely than a hand like queen jack or queen 10. You know, I think this range is probably somewhat balanced, like on a grand scale, but you know, for individual versions of this player who we don't know very much about, or I at least don't know very much about, he could be very, very unbalanced. And so, given the fact that there aren't these top-end hands available, and I actually think that I kind of like splitting the difference between our sizings, because I think that most of the Queen X would call a raise of 300, and maybe starts to fold when you get up to around 400. But yeah, I think just getting a little bit more money in on this street while things are still very fairly clean for you. And I think especially given the fact that, you know, even though maybe some two pair is possible, I think that the bet's a little bit capped such that when you get raised, you can get it in on the street, you know, pretty comfortably, putting him more on the portion of his range that are like combo draws and that sort of thing. So yeah, we've been oscillating between these two sizes, and I think maybe splitting the difference based on what we think this range looks like with a hand exactly like eights queen makes some sense.
Yeah, I also think given that leverage is not like really met right away unless I pick a really, really big size. I think 375 might meet that, but like around 300 to and change also allows me to, like you alluded to earlier, to have more options in terms of like checking back or possibly folding if it does get bad, instead of putting myself like in reverse implied odd spots where like pending the size I pick, I might be committed regardless what comes out, you know, given how much money's in the middle in relation to a stack size. So that's not always a bad thing, but I tend to, I guess, do it more and like turn to river spots where like it's going to be more black and white. And there's no more equity going forward. And if I'm already committed and he put, and I got him to put in most of his money in while I'm perceived to be ahead, I think that's fine. And we'll let the cards do the talking at that point. But here, given that we're still flop going into the turn, I think it has its merits of giving me options of navigating going forward.
Yeah, I think against like a bluff heavy player, but who's, you know, someone still at the 2-5 level, we're in a nice spot where when the heart comes, if we decide to check back, we can probably call most river sizings and potentially fold to like a river shove, because I think that
it'll be more to the top.
Yeah, players are still pretty unbalanced based on their sizing. And so I think we can bluff catch fairly accurately on like a heart blank kind of run out. You know, obviously on like a heart king run out, we might just have to fold no matter what sizing we face. Although I do think we're also fortunate in the sense that players don't bluff with hands like queen jack, queen 10, 9-10 in that spot as often as they should. And so we get to realize a little bit unfairly. And yeah, so I think SPR is such that, you know, in position, we're just going to navigate fairly effectively. And when we get this sort of beautiful blank, I like your inducing size against this range, since I think that we are going to get most of the higher equity draws to go ahead and pile, you know, having made these sort of two smaller sizings that maybe make it seem like we have a draw ourselves or a weak one pair hand. So, yeah, I like the execution here.
I do agree that like when other players take, I guess, untraditional lines in terms of leading, which most of the field doesn't do it, given that it's underutilized, we can more accurately pinpoint that his top of range, which should be included, is not included. So there's like less sets, less two pairs. It's good if he does it, but I think since underutilized, we could say that he has more combo draws. If anything, maybe like ace queen being the bottom of his top. So I think exploratively we could like fold a little bit more when it does come like heart runouts, when maybe he leads into us or like we go check and there's another heart and then like, you know, we could like fold more. So I just want to say I do like that idea, since his range is more condensed to like these heart combinations. I think people naturally, when they want to decide to like G up, they take very specific type of hands to duel with, and they don't naturally balance it out with the other hands. But I didn't want to like completely exclude the possibility that he did do it with queen x, just given his like nature and the style he was playing, because he's pretty active. So I didn't want to like completely exclude it, but if anything, I think a good practice to do is like, if I'm not 100% sure, I'll probably give him like half the combos. Like that I could have some sense of like how vastly off I am or close I am to like what's possible, if I should be stacking off or not with this guy, you know?
Yeah, no, I think that's good practice. So I'm guessing you beat him in the pot.
Oh yeah. The turn. Yeah, he as soon as he smashed, I called right away. So I ran out, dust. He actually showed me queen 10 of hearts. So we went with his ace queen. So Pau was like close to 2,000. And I think like another reason I brought this hand up is because like I won just like 2K pots, like 400 big blinds with like one pair, you know? And like I think people put too much emphasis in giving like fixed rules to like certain types of hands. Like you have top pair, like, you know, you can only get like one or two streets of value, or like you don't stack off with it, or whatever the case is. And it's like, it's not true, you know? Like there are certain dynamics that you could create that allow you to stack off lighter and lighter, you know, and you could use different variables, like the player's tendencies, the utilizing the board texture and predicting certain outcomes and tendencies from players into what they're most likely to do. And everything I did in this hand was basically trying to like utilize those tendencies in the board texture and predict what my opponent would do to set him up in a way where like he's most likely to do a mistake. And I think finding those spots to be able to do that is really good.
Yeah, I think that's a really good summary of what's happening here. It's just very in tune with what's happening in the sense that if this is queen 9-7 rainbow, then this line is just so much worse.
I still think
you can raise flop.
Yeah.
But I think betting this sort of inducing size, calling off, there's just so many fewer combos of draws that we're way ahead of on the turn that take that line, where we should just I'm not beating someone in the pot,
right?
You know, when that happens.
Yeah, I agree more on that. The only thing is, instead of me looking for like open enders and hard draws, it would just be like open enders and like the gut shots that exist on a rainbow board. And I don't think people would lead with like backdoor draws in this sense. So I think it does make it more like not as clear in terms of like raising, even though I probably will still, because those draws do still exist. And I got people behind me. So like setting up turn play versus isolating this player and setting up turn play, I think it still has merits, but it's definitely easier to see in a two-tone board for sure.
Yeah. I think the big difference between those spots to me is like, I think ace queens are raised in both, but I think king jack is, or even like ace king, mm-hmm. those are two hands I would strongly consider raising on the rainbow board and would never consider raising on the two-tone board. I think our bluffs are just going to be much more successful on the rainbow board, because when our opponent has a queen on the two-tone board, there's just this possibility that we have a flush draw staring him in the face. A lot of people, one, don't get over that, and two, don't consider that when they're bluffing themselves. What I also just really like about this hand is you're just locked into this profile on the turn, making this sizing where, you know, I think if you aren't aware of profile, you end up sort of setting up a bit of a reverse implied odds spot for yourself, where if this player is going to just call the turn, which I think is the correct play, and then fold the river, which I think, you know, when he calls the turn and you shove the river, I think that's on like a blank. I think it's a very good line. And right. That is setting up a reverse implied odds spot for you. You were able to be locked in on this profile in a way where you realize that the size was going to induce from, you know, even a hand where that is sort of, I think, is clearly in the calling world as this hand.
Given his hand?
What I'm saying is that I think his hand should very likely be a call facing a better
hand. Oh, right, right. Right.
And just because we were locked in on this profile, we were able to, you know, pick a sizing that induced a raising mistake, where really we should have been, you know, giving this player a very good price and setting up a reverse implied odds spot for ourselves.
Right. I think, like, in his perspective, like, unless he's trying to deny me from other, like, mergy hands that I could be raising on the flop, mergy being, like, maybe, like, some ace-x combination, some, like, I guess, ace-x of hearts, which would be the worst-case scenario for him. But, like, unless he thinks I'm raising, like, other hands that could potentially catch up to his hand, like, he shouldn't be raising, because, like, his hand is already so locked in his perspective and overall range perspective that, like, he should just, like, be more realizing his equity. Like, he has top pair with, like, drawing to the, like, a good heart flush, you know? and he thinks he could get more value from me from worse hands, he shouldn't be really raising.
Yeah, I agree.
Like, there's just no value for him, like unless I'm going to pay off a worse.
He simplifies his life on the river, since when you just call with his hand and face a river shove, you know, you have a tough decision. I think you can go either way, depending on your opponent and how you think your opponent's constructing. I think you have, you know, by the time of the river, many better queens with which to call. But if you feel like you need to be calling all queens, then I think it's understandable to call. But yeah, on the turn, it's sort of the classic a header behind situation. You can get some dominating draws that have fairly low equity to fold, but you know, he's just never getting a better hand to fold. Especially since I think if you did make like a sort of thin value raise on the flop with a hand like Queen Jack, which I think would be a reasonable play, I think you're a lot more likely to check the turn.
For sure.
And so yeah. If you're raising flop and betting turn and you know you have a queen or better, you're just never folding this shove. So it's just a bit of a disaster. But
yeah, like it gets to a point like where ranges have to be polarized, and like if a player is making a mistake of taking too many vulnerable hands that deserve to be checked back and realizes equity, you're simply going to be, your betting frequency is going to be way too high, and you're going to be way too vulnerable too many times where it becomes ineffective for you to implement that strategy. So given certain runouts and at certain points of the hands, you could raise like the middle part of your range. But at some point, and I think at this point in the turn, it was very pivotal that we're like, where you either have it or you don't, you know, because I'm introducing that point where like we're playing for stacks or not. I mean, I'm glad he didn't realize that I wouldn't do this with the middle of my range. And I also think like in his perspective, like, and a lot of people do this, like they just see they have a combo draw and like they just deem it to be good, like, which is good, but like it's in relation to like what's going on. Just because you have a combo draw doesn't mean like you just go crazy with it. There's some boards actually like you just shouldn't like raise. Like you should just stay in like call mode, or and some specific ones you just like go call fold, you know. And you know, alluding to what you said earlier, I think this is one of those spots where I was able to just massively exploit his tendencies, and it worked out in my favor. So I was happy with that.
Yeah, for sure. It's interesting. I think you probably don't bet nut hearts on the turn either, for this sizing at least.
Pending what I'm trying to like execute strategy wise versus the opponent against certain players, pending their tendencies, I might just check back and raise it on the river as a bluff, whether it comes or not, given that I have blockers and stuff. So that might be one aspect. And I guess more as a default, I'll probably polarize my hand versus him a little bit more, given that sometimes my ace is good versus him. So I just have so much equity that I want to put a massive amount of pressure on him, and I could do so given my hand. So, you know, I'll probably pick bigger. And yeah, to answer your point, I probably wouldn't pick the sizing, because if I think it's true that my opponent might shove over me, I'm not going to pick a sizing that allows that. So I probably will pick bigger.
Yeah.
So it'll be disastrous if I will have to fold.
Yeah, no, that would be a bit of a nightmare. Or to induce a shove from a hand like Queen Ten of Hearts also.
Yeah, that's no good.
Cage yourself. Well played. Very well played. So you mentioned that this hand took place at Sands. I know you're in New York. How long have you lived in the city?
My whole life. In terms of poker-wise, you mentioned Sands. That's basically where I have to go because it's the easiest for me to go to, transportation-wise, unless I'm going to, like, Borgata or Once in a Blue Moon Parks or something like that, or just pick some home games in the city.
Yeah. Have you ever considered moving for poker?
Yeah, it's actually in the plans. I'm in a relationship, so I'm being a good boyfriend, and I think there's a I'm really happy in my relationship, so I'm willing to sacrifice the immediate move to allow my girlfriend to like relocate with her job, get that situated, and once that's situated, I'll be moving to Vegas. Or pending where she gets a new job, might be a different state, but Vegas is on the top of the list, so that's very near in the future that we're planning to execute a move.
Congrats, man. Why Vegas? and not Philly or Florida or various poker havens?
Well, from my understanding, the ecosystem in Vegas is just like always there, and bigger games are always available. And it aligns with my future plans of like wanting to play bigger games, because I don't want to just stop and like play 2-5, 5-10 like forever. Like, I want to play bigger. And from what I see, Florida, the bigger games ends up going underground, and you need to know people and all that stuff. And I don't want to play that game. You know, like, I just want it to be available. And I think there's a cap in Florida where if I go do that, I might have to end up moving anyways. And from what I see, the bigger games are either in LA, Vegas, or like MGM National Harbor, you know, like in Washington. So those are like the easiest spots for me to go, where like that would help me in the future when I do decide to play bigger. Plus, I know a lot of more people in Vegas, so it just kind of like helps in the social aspect also of meeting the guys there and stuff. So, you know, it's a bonus.
No, for sure. I think it makes a lot of sense. It's also a very cheap place to live compared to LA, DC, even Philly.
Right. That's the other thing. I'm not rich yet. I'm trying to save the extra dollars so I can like eat, man, and pay rent.
Yeah, I guess those things are useful. So when did you realize that poker was going to be a career for you?
I've always been in love with poker. I actually was really into like pre-Black Friday. Was playing a lot online, studying. But I was doing the traditional studying of like books and videos and like everyday coaching. And then Black Friday happened. I stopped playing online. And I was playing paintball a lot back then. So I was trying to make something out of that. Paintball was rising to be pretty popular. It kind of fizzled out a bit, but it's still very popular. There's like professional leagues and everything, and like I was a captain on my team. I had a team, so I started pursuing that very heavily for like 7 years, simultaneously working a job for the bank. And then that phase of my life kind of went away with paintball. I was working in the bank, and then I realized, like, after 7 years in the bank, I was just like, I can't sit behind this desk trying to convince people why they should come to this bank like over and over for like 40 years. I just can't see that for myself. And I've always wanted to do something like untraditional and like extreme as a lifestyle. I just kind of always had that passion. And like, poker got reintroduced to me by my ex-girlfriend into my life, where I had my first live poker casino experience. And then as soon as I did that, it just hit me again, and I started pursuing it heavily, started relearning again, and I got to the point where I'm like, this is what I need to do. And I just dove head first and never looked back, and then made a commitment to myself that I'm gonna study as much as possible to get good enough to do it for a living. And I did that, and now we're here.
Where was that first casino experience?
In Harris. Oh, no, Bally's in Atlantic City.
Okay.
Yeah, it was a 1-2 there. And I actually remember seeing an old picture where, like, I didn't realize I did this at the time, but when I looked back at the picture, I stacked my chips in, like, halves, like, not the 20 stacks, like the 10 stacks. Mm-hmm. So, like, instead of stacking my red chips in hundreds, I stacked them in 50s, like, usually when you were player due. And I didn't even realize I did that. So when I look back at the picture, I'm like, oh my God, I did that. but it was there. I had a good experience. The people at the table was friendly. I actually won in my first session, so that helped, you know?
Yeah, that's good motivation. Had you played like underground games before that, or was that your first live experience?
I played live, but like with friends, like at home, right, and stuff. So like nothing serious, you know? So I had that going for me, but I never did it in a casino.
Okay.
And that was my first one. Yeah.
That's pretty awesome. And so your ex-girlfriend took you there. I don't want to put you on the spot, but I think I remember you mentioning that you met your current girlfriend in another casino related experience.
Right. This was after all that. So Yeah, that was for my birthday the first time. And then, like, we had split up. she had moved on with her career and stuff as being a teacher to a whole other country. So I was left here. So I continued playing poker. And in the midst of that, going to Sands, I actually met my girlfriend now, where we actually, I was still playing 1-2, and we will actually like run into each other a lot on the weekends because she's very, very into poker. And she will always catch my attention. But like, I was so into poker that I'm like, I'm not going to try to flirt with this girl. Like, I'm here to play. And she will like, she's very competitive too. So it would be like me and her in the same table and we run into each other and we would just like go at it. So at 1-2, where like you don't see this a lot, we would be like 3-betting, 4-betting each other. Like she'll call our check raiser. Like we were just going at it. And for a while, for like 2-3 months, every time we saw each other, like we immediately noticed each other because it's like, oh, this person again. Like, all right, I guess we're going to battle today. You know, it was like that kind of a relationship at that point. And then after a while, like we realized that we take the same bus because we both live in the city. So we take the same bus going to the casino and we're like, oh, hi, you know, it's like, what's up? And then we started talking and then now we're a couple.
Man, that's an amazing story. A Me Too warning for the audience. You know, just because she 3-bets you doesn't mean she necessarily wants to sleep with you. So
Yeah. It's all business. It's poker.
It's funny because I feel like there's a decent amount of, you know, relationships that emerge from poker. But I don't know. It strikes me that those happen more in like the tournament circuit or at the higher stakes. I just can't imagine there's that many relationships that have formed from like people commuting to like Sands from New York City to play 1-2.
Yeah, it's. I guess it was very specific for us. But I think like in general, like if we remove poker and we just replace it with like your work environment, like it's very natural to meet people in your work environment and form bonds and relationships. So it just happened to be our thing in this case, and. And it was easy for us to click right away because she's competitive, I'm competitive. We think very close aligned in terms of like goals and ambitions and like, you know, life in general. So, you know, it was very easy for us to click in that manner and just bond the relationship. And it's been great, you know, and like that happens a lot in a lot of different work environments where like you might share common interests and like you guys are there the whole time. So like, you know, at some point you're going to like talk. Unless you hate each other for some reason. And you know, you get to know people through that. And that's what happened with us. I just got lucky that, like, she's a female. She's really into poker. And then she was going to Sands. And I got really lucky in that sense. So it worked out.
So when you guys play at the same table these days, you're still, you know, getting into preflop wars?
I'm actually, like, teaching her more now. So, like, I just like stay out of her way and like I let her do her thing just so I could observe and like help her because I'm trying to help her transition to learning more of how the game works and moving up, you know. And she actually attended the last academy from what you saw. She was there also. So she's like really going hard, like trying to like, you know, improve. And like there'll be random times where like, you know, she'll come out of nowhere like, babe, I want to talk about hand history. And like, I'm trying to go to sleep or something. I'm like, all right, I guess I'm not sleeping today. You know, like, we'll talk about hand history. So yeah, I stay out of her way. I let her do her thing. But I could tell, like, she just wants to, like, 4-bet me once in a while. You know, she wants to 3-bet me when I open. Like, I see it in her eyes. I see the evil intentions.
Yeah, that's awesome. So did you first met Christian of all the Solve for Why guys? Or that's just my hunch because you're an East Coast guy.
Yeah, when I was relearning everything to get better at poker, I realized the books and videos wasn't doing it for me. It got to the point where like I learned everything to as best as I thought, and it just got repetitive after a while. And I'm like, there has to be something more. Like I felt it inside. There has to be something more than just these videos. Like there has to be something different that other people are doing because. If we're all learning the same thing, like who the hell has the edge, right? Like we're all trying to implement the same strategy more perfect than the other. So I'm like, I gotta like seek more information. So like I was doing a lot of studying at RedChip at this point, and Christian, I really liked the way he thought, and my coach at the time, which was Splitsu Sweeney, he told me that I should reach out to Christian because we share the same kind of like ambition and thought process. So he introduced me to him. From my first session, I really, really liked his thought process. And then I just like kind of got hooked and like kept working with Christian since then. And that went on for like 3 years until I got introduced to Berkey from SoftwareY. And now I work with him.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. And I guess, I would guess Matt is one of the big forces pushing you to come out to Vegas and play bigger games. You know, I think that's a path he advocates, you know, in terms of growing your business.
He never pushed it upon me, but he sees the potential. And it's just kind of natural for me to want it. So he never like really pushed me in that direction, but he always does make me think, and he does this to everybody, like really think about like your business, if you're doing this as a professional, to really understand like how it works as a business perspective and like what are your goals and ambitions to like to the details, to the T, everything. Like you really need to know the ins and outs of your cash flow and your, you know, all this stuff business related. So I gotta first understand like what my ambitions and passion is, and then like work backwards to achieve those goals and understand what it's going to take to achieve those goals and ambition, and then make a plan and just execute, you know? So he really does a good job of bringing that up and to the forefront so you could really understand it.
Awesome, man. So you've taken about an hour of your time. I'm rusty with the, you know, my podcasting muscle, at least from the Just Hands side, is a little rusty. You know, I lean on Matt Hunt these days to, you know, get me through an episode. And anyway, again, I just, you know, I really appreciate you coming on. I know that some of these guys listening right now would be interested in following along with the journey, your, you know, impending move to the West Coast, or perhaps, I guess I don't know if it's 100% a certainty now, or I know you coach a lot of people out here on the East Coast, and maybe they want to get in touch with you, learn more about your approach to those games, which I know that you're among the most successful, you know, in the world at beating these, you know, East Coast 2-5 games, which is sort of an art in itself. Where can people get in touch with you, follow along with you, and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, for sure. So if you want to follow along, I have an Instagram and Twitter. So it's @FaustoValdez, and Instagram is Fausto_Valdez. My name is a little weird. It's FAUSTO and then VALDEZ, Valdez. And if people want to understand more about what I do as a coach, since I take care of students also, I have a curriculum set up where I teach people holistically about strategy. So if they want to find out more, they could reach me FaustoValdez123@gmail.com. Just shoot me an email and we'll talk.
Awesome, man. Appreciate having you on, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it. Take care.